Hello, and welcome to On the Mind, the official podcast of the Weill Cornell Medicine Department of Psychiatry. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Knuffelmacher. In each episode, I speak with experts in various aspects of psychiatry, psychotherapy, neuroscience, and other important topics on the mind. With recent advances in neuroscientific research, we've improved our understanding of how emerging treatments like transcranial magnetic stimulation or psychedelic agents affect the brain. We have some understanding of how they provide therapeutic benefit to people suffering from common conditions like depression, PTSD, and OCD. The use of psychiatric medications and treatments like focused magnetic stimulation of targeted brain regions create noticeable neurobiological change in the brain. But what happens in the brain with an older, widely practiced, evidence-based treatment like psychotherapy? In fact, there are multiple studies using functional magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs, that show discrete biological changes occurring in the brain after successful psychotherapy. It should also be noted that the majority of positive results in studies of psychedelics, an area of significant research currently, are being done in combination with psychotherapy. Yet, in the field of psychiatry, there's a tendency to be divided in our thinking about psychotherapy versus biological treatments, a conceptual split that separates the psychological from the neurobiological and the mind from the brain. Today, we want to challenge that dualistic thinking by delving into the neuroscience of psychotherapy. To help guide us in this effort, we're joined by Dr. Susan Vaughn. Dr. Vaughn is the Aaron R. Stern Associate Professor of Psychiatry in the Weill Cornell Medicine Department of Psychiatry. She's an accomplished psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who has researched and written about psychodynamic psychotherapy, including in her book, The Talking Cure, The Science Behind Psychotherapy. In addition to her body of scholarly work, she's an experienced teacher who leads a course for senior psychiatry residents at Weill Cornell on the neuroscience of psychodynamic psychotherapy. Susan, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Daniel, it's so great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Well, I want to jump right in and ask you, what led you to be interested in the neuroscience of psychodynamic psychotherapy?
I think it's hard to say exactly what got me interested. All I know is that I've been interested for the longest time, and ever since I can remember growing up. I remember finding an old copy of one of Freud's works that I had read as a teenager and finding that I had tried to label the different brain regions he was talking about as he talked about the id, the ego, and the superego. So I think it's something that I've always wondered. To me, it's the ultimate mystery and kind of the final frontier. How do chemicals in the brain give rise to the phenomenon of the self, to our sense of how do chemicals in the brain give rise to something as complex as the mind, which encompasses our sense of self, our experiences every day, our relationships with other people. To me, that's the ultimate challenge, is to figure that out.
Well, given this prevailing tendency that splits the mind and the brain, which I alluded to, and with that, a split between biological psychiatry versus psychotherapeutic treatments, can you say a little bit about that history in our field, the relationship between neuroscientific research and psychodynamic psychotherapy? You brought up Freud, which at that point, I think there wasn't a split because that was where the state of science was. But obviously, things have progressed over the years. And I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think really the split goes way back to Descartes and the idea of the rational being and then the soul versus the mind. I think that there's a long history of trying to split things into different components, and the mind and the soul and experiences like that have always been considered almost like epiphenomena or things that arise from the workings of the brain, but without a lot of thought to, well, how do they work and what's important and interesting about how they work? And the real prize has been for quite a while now within psychiatry on really pinning down the neuroscience and pinning down sort of the chemicals and the brain structures that give rise to the mind. I think that's in part because the mind is very complicated to try to study. And yet I think it's actually the most interesting part of all of us is sort of this internal world that we construct and this view of ourselves and other people that we walk around with and the way that affects the information we take in and how we process things every day as we're going through life. So I think it goes way back. I think we're actually in a position more than we have been in the past to think about how do they fit together, though. And for one thing that surprised me in starting my practice was that even my very smartest patients were surprised by the idea that what we did in psychotherapy actually changed their brains. Yet on the other hand, how could it be otherwise? Because what would be changing if not their brains that give rise to how they think about life day to day?
Well, you alluded to the complexity of the mind. Obviously, the brain is equally complex, but we're studying that and making progress in that area. But thinking about the mind, I'm curious about the concepts that are used in psychodynamic psychotherapy, things like the concept of the unconscious or defenses or transference. Are there ways that these psychotherapeutic concepts can be linked to neurobiology, some kind of mechanisms or underlying processes in the brain?
I think that psychodynamic psychotherapy, we use some very basic concepts. For example, the idea of the dynamic unconscious, that within all of us, there are these forces that are unconscious that are influencing our behavior all the time and that they're out of our awareness and they only come through when we look at slips of the tongue, errors we make, saying the wrong word than what we meant, but having it have meaning. And I think that the dynamic unconscious is something that Freud noted, which is this sort of cauldron of different desires and wishes and fears that are only really available to us through behavior and thinking patterns and things that we see happening on the surface of the mind. But the idea that there's a driving force and that the driving force behind the mind is things like attachments to other people, sexual or aggressive wishes, emotions like jealousy, things like protecting our sense of ourself, that those are all sort of motivators of things we want to reveal, but also want to conceal from ourselves at the same time. So in terms of phenomena that we talk about in psychotherapy and psychodynamic psychotherapy, like transference, I think we have probably learned these models in very early life from our caretakers and our parents. And the early models about how to have a relationship that we have are encoded in our brains, and we walk around and lay those down on new situations. So it's not surprising when someone finds they have a boss that's, quote, just like their father, because I think that they're primed in relationships to look for patterns that are similar to the ones they experienced with a mother or a father in early life and to reproduce those. So part of what psychodynamic psychotherapy does is go back through those early models and those early sets of rules about how relationships work and try to challenge them and try to rewire them and try to change the underlying brain representation such that they operate differently in the mind and that the representation that you're acting on in daily life becomes different. So perhaps you're able to see things about your boss that are not entirely like your father, or you're able to bypass some of the things that bother you that are similar to your father by reminding yourself, well, that's a very loaded pattern for me. And now I know more about why, having understood it in a psychodynamic psychotherapy and mainly having experienced it in relationship to my therapist, I can actually see the patterns that are there. And I see what I'm actually bringing to and doing in these relationships that makes them challenging to change from the past.
With all of what you just described, there are important functions, things like memory, emotions. You're describing increasing self-awareness or consciousness of the self. Can you speak a bit about where these processes lie in the brain? I mean, even some maybe basic neuroanatomy that can give us a sense of correspondence between the brain and these important pieces of psychodynamic psychotherapy?
I think one important thing is where they don't lie. And where they don't lie is actually in memory in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is very important. It's a structure that isn't fully online at birth. It comes online and is more fully developed going into year two, two and a half of life. And if we look at when people begin to remember events that happened in their lives, It's usually around 2 to 3 years and somewhere in that range. And those are often memories that are very loaded by emotion. So it'll be a traumatic memory, getting separated from a parent, for example, like at the mall or because you're in the hospital. It'll be a very loaded emotional memory. But before that, we do have another kind of memory going on. And that kind of memory is a very slow, gradual memory of how to do things. Like it's a memory for procedures, like how do I know how to breastfeed? You know, I've done this before. I know that mom does this and then I do that and this is what happens. And then suddenly I'm full and sleepy. So I learn series of procedures that happen in daily life. I know what it's like to have my diaper changed. I know what it's like to be put down in my crib to go to sleep. And there's a certain set of procedures that unfolds around all of those things. So I think in early life, learning how to have a relationship is a little bit like learning how to ride a bicycle. It's something you do by practice. It's something you do by everyday variations on a theme, which are probably not very strong variations. And the way the brain takes care of that kind of information, like a procedure, is by encoding it, a kind of general representation of it. So I get a general sense of what life is like in terms of relating to my mother or my father or caretaker, just by experience in early life. And that doesn't require the hippocampus at all. That's probably something that's stored in other brain regions, maybe in the parietal lobe or associational cortex in the brain. And it's important because it accrues very slowly over time. And it's the way I make a prototype of what having a relationship is like.
So it's not conscious then?
It's something that's not conscious. It's something that happens slowly by accrual of experiences of things, and it gets laid down. But it's a very powerful model. You might think of it also as a model. Like we all know the procedure for eating at a McDonald's, whether we like to do that or not. We know the drill, right? We go in, we go up to the front, we order our food, we pay, we wait for our tray to come out, then we go find a seat, put our tray away when we're done eating. We know how that works. And we don't need a separate memory of every time we do that any more than we need a separate memory of every event of breastfeeding or diapering. What we really need is a kind of general model of how it works. And that's what we're developing in early life that's being encoded in the brain as a set of procedures of how to have a relationship. And the thing is, having relationships comes naturally, but it comes naturally the way you learned it, which is a procedure you learned of how to relate to people, which is why if you're dealing with a depressed caregiver or a parent who's very anxious or other circumstances where the way we learn to relate to people is sort of warped by early life experience, we're going to learn with early caregivers how to relate to someone who's quite depressed or anxious. And then we're going to approach everyone as if we have to be equally careful as we had to be with a caregiver, for example, who's impaired by depression or anxiety. So it's really going to bias every relationship we have in later life. And it isn't so much meant to blame parents. It's just that parents are the first example how to do something like relating. So because they're the first example, they're very important and they take up a much bigger part of our representations of how things work because they're the first examples. So everything later comes on top of that, but every later example of a relationship that we average into that isn't as important as the first ones and beginning to get that procedural memory rolling that tells us how to have a relationship.
So these early life experiences inform the relationships we have as adults. Some repeated patterns occur, which can be altered for the better in psychodynamic psychotherapy. Underlying this, you're talking about some really formative relationships, obviously, in early life. And what comes to mind is attachment. Attachment theory. So I'm curious if you could, for our audience, speak a bit about attachment theory in the role of psychodynamic psychotherapy, but also what neuroscience is underlying some of the theories of attachment.
Theories of attachment are really fascinating. We know that babies come incredibly pre-wired for attachment. For example, in the first few hours of life, they prefer the smell of their mother's breast milk over anyone else's breast milk. They'll orient to the sound of their mother or father's voices differently than they will to another adult voice that isn't their parent. They really come wired to attach to a caregiver And that's very important because we wouldn't be able to survive without that. We're pretty helpless in the animal kingdom, and we go on for 18 years or more needing support of our families and their attention to our development. And without the early caregivers, we wouldn't know how to relate to anyone or how things work in the world. The thing is, we're learning a lot about how that happens from our caregivers themselves. So there are different attachment styles. There's secure attachment style, and that's looked at by what happens when we separate from a parent. So a normal attachment style would be a child's upset when the mother leaves the room and leaves them with a stranger, but they're able to be comforted by the stranger and they're able to settle back into play. And then they're happy to see the caregiver when the mother comes back in the room. And they're able also to return fairly quickly to play or to exploring the room or doing other things that don't involve the mother. That's how we know that attachment's really solid. I can kind of touch base with you. I'll miss you when you're gone, but I anticipate you coming back. When you do come back, I'm happy. And that's very different than insecure attachments in which a child is either very clingy and sort of angry seeming, very fussy with the mother, even before they leave. And then upon reunion is again, very clingy and very fussy and unable to settle down into playing by themselves or playing with a stranger. They're really unable to let go of, is the mother going to come back? And the quality of it in that kind of attachment is a sort of, I hate you, but I don't want you to leave me. It's sort of angry at the mother, but also, you know, attached to her in this way that is clingy and feels very frustrating for a lot of mothers. And another kind of attachment is an insecure, avoidant attachment in which children are seem not to care when the mother leaves the room and also seem not to care when she comes back, if you just look at their behavior. But if you look at what's happening underneath that and you look at things like their heart rate and blood pressure, they're very clearly very affected by her leaving the room and coming back. And you can see in all of their autonomic symptoms of their heart rate and things like that, that they're very affected, but they act unaffected. And they can give the impression of, in relationships, that they just really don't care very much. They're not very involved or engaged. And even though that's not true, that can be a problematic pattern for them with in later romantic relationships, for example, to seem like, you can stay or you can go. I'm not that affected one way or the other by it. It's a very problematic thing in a relationship, even in a friendship. So those early attachment styles seem to be very pre-wired into the brain. You can actually predict what the attachment style will be in a baby looking at the mother while she's pregnant, because it will tend to mirror the mother's style, or it will be an insecure attachment if the mother has an insecure attachment. So these things do seem to get passed down, probably both in part genetically, but also in terms of how the mother relates to the baby and how that sets up the baby's own sense of what attachments are possible to people. So I'd say that the baby's temperament, which is their kind of resting state, are they calm and kind of a mellow baby? People talk about sort of good, easy babies or babies that are more fussy and difficult. But temperament plus attachment is really getting us set up in a way for what kinds of relationships are possible. And then the early life relationships with the caregivers really set up what kinds of relationships are possible in later life. Like, what are the bounds we see for how to relate to another person?
All of this is hugely influential from early life on into adult life. What's going on in the brain? And you talk about wiring, but what are the regions and the underlying neurobiology that's involved in these processes?
We think that there are definitely important loops between various areas of the cortex and the limbic system, which is really there for emotional regulation, that get activated by these representations of the self and others. And what's happening as we're forming a sense of how others operate in relationships, we're also forming an impression of ourself and how we operate in relation to other people. And so we're really forming the self-representation that'll be the basis for thinking we're a good or a bad person, or we're a person who likes relationships and is good at them or not during those early caregiving experiences. And so I think in adult life, we have important corticolimbic loops that are links between our representation of ourself and other people and the emotions that go with that, whether they're positive or whether they're negative, or whether other people misunderstand what we're intending in a relationship, or they kind of are able to relate to us and they are able to have a relationship with us that's meaningful. And we're really laying down all of that neural circuitry in the first several years of life in the setting of these early caregiving relationships.
Just to expand on that a little bit for our audience, you spoke about the cortex, cortico, and the limbic system in the brain. Can you speak a little bit about the difference between those two regions and what their functions are?
The cortex is much more an area for information processing in the brain. And so probably the actual representations of self and other people are somehow in the cortex, but they're very much shot through with emotional content as well, because having a relationship is an emotional thing. And so both the cortex areas, which are for information processing, and also the limbic areas, which tell us the emotion attached to that information, are highly important in thinking about how we relate to other people and in setting up representations of how that operates in the brain.
I'm wondering, as we talk about all of this, if you can provide a few examples of some neuroscientific research, maybe specific studies that demonstrate brain processes underlying the therapeutic effects of psychodynamic psychotherapy.
Well, we know from studies of learning and memory that when we're changing the brain, we're changing neural circuitry. We've seen how changing how information is processed requires changes in brain structure. We've also seen in studies of SSRIs and medications like Zoloft and Prozac that changing the level of serotonin changes the amount of neural scaffolding that we build, which allows us to build new neuronal connections. So SSRIs, for example, are very powerful in allowing us to build neural connections that are stronger and faster, and that we're able to build them better because of the amount of serotonin that we have around. So we know those two building blocks of making new connections and making them better in the presence of more serotonin. And those give us a clue as to what's happening when we're actually rewiring individual representations. We don't have evidence in the brain of exactly where that's happening or exactly what is happening, but we do know that those are two important mechanisms that are going on all the time when we're changing things in the brain in response to psychological experience or to the relationships we have with the therapist in psychodynamic psychotherapy.
So in describing those changes, you're talking about the recruitment of new neurons and changes that occur in the brain, what I think is more commonly called neuroplasticity. I think in the old days, there was this idea that the brain was fixed and wasn't as plastic of an organ as we now know it to be. So could you speak about how that is in play when it comes to psychodynamic psychotherapy?
I think we now know that the adult brain is highly plastic, less so than when someone is very young, but on the other hand, extremely plastic in terms of storing new information. And I think that ability to change is the key behind psychodynamic and all psychotherapies, really, is that you're recognizing a pattern of behavior or thought or emotion that you're trying to work on, and that you really do have the capacity to change that quite a bit by understanding it, by experiencing the emotion associated with it in the room with a psychotherapist. And I think that the capacity of the brain to really change, like link by link. I mean, if you look at what is happening in the brain, the fact that there is sprouting of all different kinds of new synapses, there's, you know, the dendrites, which are the end of the neuron that are connecting to the axons of the prior neuron, are getting more and more bushy. They're forming new connections that they didn't have before with nearby neurons. We actually are able now to track them in a live way, like in a live animal model, where we can see what parts of the brain are experiencing branching and connections that weren't there before. And we can also show that it really is a case of kind of use it or lose it, that neurons that are firing together repeatedly as you're talking about something are going to wire themselves together and support the process of change. Whereas if you don't use them at all, neural connections are going to be lost. And so I think that's exactly what we're trying to do in a psychotherapy, is make new connections and let some of the old connections be lost. Let them go by the wayside so that we aren't stuck in the same kinds of ruts and patterns that we've been in previously. So the ability of the brain to change is really striking and really impressive, even in an adult brain.
So again, the therapeutic change that we see in the mind is corresponding with change in the brain.
Absolutely. And I think seeing the change in the mind that accompanies the change in the brain is very exciting. And also for patients, it's very useful to know that the change in the brain underlies that and is going on. Because I think there's the feeling that psychotherapy is kind of just talking. But psychotherapy is a lot more than just talking. It's actually rewiring the brain. And it's actually important because if you're just talking, it's probably not a great psychotherapy that's going on. What you need to be doing is talking about patterns and looking for things that are recognizable between sessions and things that are happening recurrently with a psychotherapist and really examining those patterns. So no matter what kind of psychotherapy you're in, it should be very pattern focused, because without that, it's kind of meandering around in the forest as opposed to really keying in on where are the well-worn trails and how do we want to change those.
Well, this relates to, I think, something you said in the beginning when you were talking about a smart patient kind of trying to understand the process of what was going on in psychotherapy. And you're pointing out how much this knowledge can be helpful in the process. And I'm curious how individuals, whether they're therapists or patients, can use insights from neuroscience to better understand and engage in the psychodynamic therapeutic process.
I think they can realize that the patterns we're trying to understand are very complex in psychodynamic psychotherapy. They're generally easier in things like dialectic behavior therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. They may be patterns of thought, like catastrophizing would be an example where once something goes wrong, you assume a whole chain of events is going to go wrong and you sort of build that up until it snowballs into a giant thought that everything is going to be terrible. That might be something easier to pick apart than in a relationship. I tend to start off really strong and then I tend to withdraw as the other person gets closer. But that's going to be a harder pattern to bring to life in a psychotherapy and actually examine in relationship to the therapist. You're going to have to realize that you're starting strong. You're going to have to realize the point at which you withdraw. You're going to have to think about the reasons why you might withdraw and what it is about the therapist moving closer that might scare you. So there are going to be different kinds of patterns we're recognizing, but all psychotherapy should really be pattern recognition. And I think when clinicians realize that and patients realize that, we can stay more focused on what we're really trying to do. And it makes it different than just having a conversation with a friend where you're kind of meandering through what your concerns are. It makes it a very much more focused process. And I think it encourages both therapist and patient to really think about that and engage with that process in sessions. That's one of the reasons I think it's really interesting, is that to me, it gets patients to take psychotherapy in some ways more seriously because the brain seems more serious than the mind, or it seems more tangible than the mind. And so knowing that we're trying to rewire their brains can really orient both therapist and patient into focusing in a way that's a little bit different than they might normally do.
Do you have any examples, you can of course make them de-identified, that highlight from the work that you've done with patients the interplay between using these brain-based ways of thinking about things within psychodynamic psychotherapy and how maybe that's helped individuals that you've worked with achieve positive outcomes in their therapy?
I think it helps people understand that relating the past to the present is really worth doing, and that if they're pulling away in a romantic relationship and they're beginning to put extra distance between themselves and the person, and they're able to relate that back to feeling rejected by a mother who, for example, couldn't really stay with them because she was too depressed or too anxious. So she always, as they would be closer or talking in a more intensive way growing up, the mother would really be pulling back. Seeing that they're doing what the mother did and that they need to try, although it will be uncomfortable, to lean into staying a little closer to a person and trying to understand what are they afraid of can make a giant difference in how they're able to relate to other people in their lives and therefore to the quality of what their lives, their sense of themselves, their sense of other people and their place in the world can be. And meanwhile, it's a process they wouldn't have been aware of growing up. They just have the mother they have and they assume, well, that's how people relate. And these patterns are very comfortable and they're literally very familiar in the sense that they were installed in this family setting. And therefore, people can meet people that are like a parent and feel very comfortable with them, yet be very frustrated in relation to them, like they're never quite getting what they hope to get out of the relationship. They never quite have the sense that the person really sees them and can understand them. And they're in this chronic pattern of pulling away and of like approaching the person again, getting disappointed and pulling away. And it will take time to understand that, but it's very powerful when people begin to see that and change that. And you can see their relationships change often quite rapidly when they really get that's what's going on.
And the psychotherapy works, which is why we do it.
Yep, psychotherapy works. It's evidence-based. It can be combined with medication effectively. It can be used instead of medication in many cases very effectively. And there are certain kinds of problems where there just is no other kind of solution that will work. I can't give you a medicine that will fix the fact that you tend to pull away in close relationships and therefore feel isolated and rejected. That's not something I can change in any other way than getting in there with you and trying to look at the pattern and change it.
It's about the application of the right psychotherapy for the right problem, similar to using the right medication for the right diagnosis as well.
Exactly. And psychodynamic psychotherapy is often good for problems that are longstanding, that seem kind of intractable, where the person knows that they're not feeling as good as they could about their relationships. Maybe they want a family and they haven't been able to find a partner. Kind of long-term issues where people are chronically feeling unhappy about where things are in their lives in terms of relating to other people. Psychodynamic psychotherapy is often the best treatment for that kind of problem.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for delving into this with us today. I look forward to learning more from you as you continue your work teaching the public about the benefits of psychodynamic psychotherapy. Thank you for joining me on today's episode of On the Mind.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been fun to talk about it with you.
Thanks. And thank you to all who listened to this episode of On the Mind, the official podcast of the Weill Cornell Medicine Department of Psychiatry. Our podcast is available on all major streaming platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you heard today, tell your friends, give us a rating, and subscribe so you can stay up to date with all of our latest episodes. We'll be back soon with another guest expert, so be sure to tune in again to On the Mind.
Back to Health is your source for the latest in health, wellness, and medical care for the whole family. Our team of world-renowned physicians at Weill Cornell Medicine are having in-depth conversations covering trending health topics, wellness tips, and medical breakthroughs. With the spotlight on our collaborative approach to patient care, the series will present cutting-edge treatments, innovative therapies, as well as real-life stories that will answer common questions for both patients and their caregivers. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, don't forget to rate us 5 stars.
All information contained in this podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes. The information is not intended nor suited to be a replacement or substitute for professional medical treatment or for professional medical advice relative to a specific medical question or condition. We urge you to always seek the advice of your physician or medical professional with respect to your medical condition or questions. Weill Cornell Medicine makes no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast, and any reliance on such information is done at your own risk. Participants may have consulting, equity, board membership, or other relationships with pharmaceutical, biotech, or device companies unrelated to their role in this podcast. No payments have been made by any company to endorse any treatments, devices, or procedures, and Weill Cornell Medicine does not endorse, approve, or recommend any product, service, or entity mentioned in this podcast. Opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker and do not represent the perspectives of Weill Cornell Medicine as an institution.